It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. Today we're going to be talking about what should we eat. Before I get started, I wanted to let you know that UC Davis has a new podcast called Unfold. It takes a look at complicated problems and discusses solutions with experts. And this season, they have been focusing on sustainably feeding a growing population. The host, Amy Quinlan and Alexa Renee, examine the debate over switching to plant-based diets, GMOs, gene-edited food, food waste, and the politics of food. It's a fun and interesting listen, and you can find Unfold on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and YouTube. Now, what should we eat? There are professionals to help us answer that question, and they're called registered dietitians, and over 10,000 of them attended the Food and Nutrition Conference in Philadelphia, sponsored by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. I'm happy to say that one of those respected dietitians in Philadelphia, Sharon Palmer, is with us today. Sharon is an author, registered dietitian, an expert on the food system, and a respected proponent of plant-based diets. Sharon, you've gone to many of these conferences. What do you get from them?
Yes, well, I think I've been to something like 30 of those conferences by now, and it's, you know, as a dietitian, we call it the Super Bowl of nutrition. It's our big event of the year. We all meet in the city of the conference, and we network, we meet with each other, we find out what's the latest in nutrition, and it's just something that we look forward to all year long and that we just can't miss.
Well, it's not an inexpensive thing, I suppose. I mean, people are coming from not only all over the country, I imagine they come from all over the world, because this is probably the largest event in the world, isn't it, of dietitians?
Yes, they do. They do come from all over the world. It's primarily people within our country, but we do see dietitians coming in from all over the world, and it is the largest food nutrition conference on the planet. And as you said, it's more than 10,000 dietitians, but we also have people in the food industry. We have researchers, academia, people in food service, restaurants. So, there are a lot of people in the whole world of food and nutrition that, you know, make a point to come to that conference, to network and to learn about what's going on.
So when you say about learning what's going on, so they can go to different rooms where there are speakers and quite a few going on at one time, I would imagine, and keynote sessions, and they're sharing ideas. And then there's an exhibit floor that has hundreds, I don't know how many, companies that are showing what products and information and services that dietitians will be interested in?
Yes, we have speakers, groundbreaking sessions on nutrition, food policy, health, wellness, disease prevention, nutrients, all those topics. And then there's a large exhibition floor so that sponsors and food companies and organizations can exhibit their information, and you can see what's going on with food development and nutrition programs. And then there are networking events, media events. It just goes on and on. And then even within the organization, it's Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, as you mentioned, that is behind the FNCE. We call it FNCE, Food Nutrition Conference Expo. So the Academy has various memberships that are able to convene. For example, I'm in the Vegetarian Nutrition Dietetic Practice Group. So that gives us an opportunity to meet and have, and to discuss policies and programs that we're hoping to work towards. So it's really this time where we can all get together and look at what's going on and look at how we want advanced food nutrition in the coming year.
So I would guess that when these 10,000 plus people decide they're going to go to the conference, some of them are having their expenses reimbursed by an employer. Some of them are in business for themselves and just figure that they just need to go and it's cost to be in the business. And they're spending maybe $800 or $1,000 on plane tickets and have to spend a couple $100 a night for hotel rooms. And then there's a registration fee. So it's a pretty significant investment.
Yes. And there were days when your employer might have paid for Fancy. And indeed, I've had jobs as I used to be a clinical dietitian in a hospital. And years ago, I had a reimbursement, an education reimbursement fund. So I chose it for Fancy. But now it's getting increasingly rare that dietitians have somebody paying for their education expenses. So a lot of dietitians are paying for this out of their pockets. And then, a lot of dietitians aren't going because they can't, they simply can't afford the rate and the fee. Dietitians have to have continuing education units. We have to have 75 continuing education units per 5-year reporting period. So this is a great time for us to, get stocked up on our continuing education, but it's still very expensive, like you said. Although I see dietitians doing creative things, like some of my colleagues did Airbnb and got a bunch of dietitians together to share a room. So there are creative ways to help fund or help at least make it less expensive.
So I would imagine if they pick up ideas from the floor, from the presentations, from their conversations with their colleagues, they go home and in their practice, if they're a consultant or if they are, say, work for hospitals or something like that, they may take some of what they used and have an impact on what their new recommendations are, that they may be doing something a little bit different or have another idea or present information differently because of something they gained. Again, either sitting and listening to somebody or conversations with colleagues or things they got on the floor. They take home and put it to use.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is a chance for you to learn about the latest in nutrition to advance your career as a dietitian. And dietitians work in many settings. The most common setting is to work in a hospital. So you might have been to the hospital and a dietitian might have helped you figure out what sort of diet you should be on if you have a disease condition, or they might have, helped you with certain thing. Maybe you were feeling very sick and you needed to get nutrition while you're in the hospital. So those are some things that dietitians might have helped you with. But dietitians also work in settings like in private practice, like a doctor's office where they make appointments with you and help you with your diet to meet your needs. Dietitians work in wellness environments. For example, at Fancy this year, I met the Apple dietitian. She works with Apple. She's working with making sure that the employees at Apple are as healthy as they can be.
I'm glad you added that sentence because I was thinking of the fruit. And we're having this conversation. We're on our iPhones right now that we're having,
right.
Using those for this this conversation, but somehow it just took me about 3 sentences before I caught up with you because obviously Apple's still a pretty good thing for dietitians to recommend.
Yes. Yeah, so, we like apples in both ways.
yeah, that's right. But still, and somebody comes to a conference like this, maybe they're coming to seek out some additional clarification, but it'll come with a radical change in mind. I mean, you mentioned that you're in a group that includes a plant-based and the vegetarian group that you're getting involved with. Someone's not going to come as a dietitian and then just come and join your group and say, now I've decided to become a vegetarian or I've decided that that's going to be my emphasis. I would think that they're looking to put a finer point on whatever area is their specialty and their interest, rather than expecting to come and get turned around in a whole new direction or anything like that.
Yeah, that's right. I think dietitians now are really specializing, just like the medical practices. So you may have a dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition. Critical care, is a very important field to be in as a dietitian because you can help manage people when they're critically ill, whether they need particular nutrients in tube feedings or parenteral nutrition. There's just so many different fields, geriatric nutrition for the elderly. plant-based nutrition as an, I'm involved in education. So there's just all different sorts of areas that dietitians can be involved with. So, you know, when they go to Fenty, they may be really fine-tuning their interests and trying to develop their skills, to stay on top of their skills, to make them, you know, really relatable and efficient in their practice.
You know, one of the controversies, I think, recently, the controversy if you raise livestock are the suggestions that we ought to eat a lot less animal products, period. Does an idea like that get surfaced at Fenty?
Yeah, it is a public issue. Right. Mm-hmm. It's something that was discussed this year. It's been discussed in years in the past. And it's really, you know, my philosophy, and I think the Academy's philosophy and the philosophy that was expressed a lot this year is it's really this positive idea of eating a more plant-based diet. So instead of, you know, focusing on the negative aspects of that kind of a diet shift, it's just like trying to make sure you're filling your plate with 3/4 plant foods at least. And so that means making that animal portion of the plate a little bit smaller. And this is based on a lot of research on health benefits and now increasingly on sustainability benefits. So this is actually something that's been around for a while, but it's getting more attention. So, you know, eating more legumes, things like beans, lentils, dried peas, those kinds of things can take the place of the animal foods on the plate. So this was something that was talked about this year as it has been in years past.
You know, to talk about things like that in the past, they've created various pyramids. And I've seen, you know, a Mediterranean pyramid, and there is a pyramid when it was originally established by the USDA. Are pyramids still in fashion, or are there other ways that people are trying to represent graphically, you know, what they should be heading towards in the mix of what they're eating?
Well, in the most recent years, they've been using something called MyPlate, which is the, it comes from the Dietary Guidelines, which is the government's recommendations when they have an expert panel and they look at all of the science on the Americans' diets and health risks related to diet. The Scientific Advisory Committee comes up with some major recommendations of how we need to eat to be healthier. And that is kind of funneled into these simple recommendations, and it's graphically expressed on a plate. So this plate kind of shows you like how much of that plate should be filled with protein foods, like animal proteins like chicken or fish or beef, or plant proteins as well, things like lentils, beans, that kind of thing. And then a fourth of it with grains, hopefully mostly whole grains, and the rest with like fruits and vegetables and those kinds of things. So that's like this kind of a plate concept. Now, you do still see some of these pyramids out there, like the Mediterranean diet has a beautiful pyramid, and those are out there too. But the government's interpretation is this plate sort of symbol.
Well, I have a feeling we're not talking cutting edge, but we're talking kind of a practical takeaway from this. But if we go back to the cutting edge, what was getting people stirred up? What if anything happened among the attendees was a topic that got people's attention?
I know a lot of people were talking about the sustainability talk that Walter Willett from Harvard gave on the Eat Lancet report, which is a pretty recent set of guidelines for planetary health. You know, we're getting people are more and more concerned about the environment, climate change, and how their lifestyle can impact the environmental, the environment. So this is a really a wonderful report that provides recommendations of how, you know, with our diets, we could reduce our impact on the planet. So some of the recommendations, like we just talked about, eating more of a plant-based diet, reducing sugar intake. A lot of us don't think about sugar as a way to reduce your environmental footprint, but the producing, sugar, which is it's not a nutritious ingredient. In fact, we know more and more research shows that too much sugar has health risks. So by putting all that agriculture to produce sugar, it could be producing something healthier instead, right? So some of the times we focus on things like eating more plants, which of course is healthy, but we should also look at producing really healthful crops and healthful foods, because when we put a lot of energy into producing foods that aren't really that healthful, that's the, you know, the opposite of sustainability. So that was one thing talked about a lot.
So who would have been opposed to what he's suggesting? Where do his critics come from?
So there has been some criticism about that report, but it didn't address like the developing nations, where, you know, you may have developing nations that rely on animal foods. There's just no way they can feed themselves because maybe they don't have a climate or soils that support crop cultivation. So it wouldn't be an appropriate recommendation for globally to say every single country should reduce meat consumption, right? But, you know, that a lot of times that report has, it does mention the fact that this is for Western societies where we have the ability to eat more of a plant-based diet. So that's, you know, been one argument that it wouldn't apply for every single country.
I even wonder whether sugar is sugar. Because when you were talking earlier about the footprint of sugar, on the one hand, they can't get much of an argument probably among dietitians that it's best to cut back on sugar, period. But it is a new idea to look at it through the climate perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether sugar beets are different from the footprint of high fructose corn syrup that comes from corn or sugar cane.
Yes, I'm sure all those footprints are different. I'm not really versed on the comparison of those, but every crop has a different footprint. And then when you look at the processing, the production and there's the crop cultivation and then there's the processing. What is the footprint of the actual processing of these types of sweeteners? And then one of the things, people usually think of sustainability just as the environment, but sustainability also means the impact on people and communities and also economics. So, you know, perfectly sustainable food would have a lower impact on the planet and our resources and the environment, but it would also have, you know, a lower negative impact on humans. So that's where health comes in. You know, healthy eating is sustainable because it's a sustainable for human health. So that's another aspect of sustainability.
So you have people attending conferences like this, and so they're getting the report that they should think about this impact on the climate of their food choices, and it's somewhat controversial. They leave the room where if the presentation took place, and they go down an escalator or something onto the trade floor where there's hundreds of booths, some of them that have positions that are diametrically opposed to what Dr. Willock was saying. So I would imagine you could wander out on the floor and you could find someone that has a vested interest in saying, oh, not so fast. You know, they're being critical of whatever it is we're producing. But here's the other side of the story. That's
exactly right. That's exactly what happens. And that's our, you know, our food world today is that we have people that have an interest in you know, having certain messages, and sometimes the science out there doesn't always support the message of a particular food industry, and dietitians have to be really good at measuring all of that and trying to approach it in a way that makes sense, and then to also help their clients, you know, where this is the one thing dietitians have always been really good at is reaching people where they're at, you know, looking at their clients and when it comes to their diets and their eating patterns, trying to figure out how they can help them best where they're at.
So when you go down to the floor where all these companies are exhibiting, I know it's been controversial in the past that organizations that may make soda pops start coming in, and fast food chains would be exhibiting there. Mm-hmm. And when I've attended before, there was tension that some people felt, you know, you shouldn't even have a conference like this and have, you know, fast food or manufactured products that have lots of different ingredients in them. And they may have been more of a of a purist of wanting to see somebody there with avocados, for example, but not necessarily some product that has lots of ingredients that you can't pronounce and sold in with excessive packaging and that sort of thing. And so you just felt like there was a little tension between people that felt that it had gone too far in the commercialization and this further processing representation there versus the more kind of pure, simple, single ingredient sort of commodities. Mm-hmm. Does that tension exist, or is it a tension? Am I reading too much into it?
Yeah, I think it's existed, and in my opinion, it was even worse. The Academy has suffered through a lot of controversy about their sponsorship programs, and they put, you know, and those were in the days when you literally saw sugar-sweetened beverages everywhere, and very unhealthful foods that no dietitian would ever recommend would be literally on the floor of the, you know, exhibition hall. And since then, there's been a lot of outcry among dietitians who are members. One of the biggest complaints they've had is, how can our association ever support these products? And the association, you know, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics has listened, and they've created a sponsorship program that has set higher standards for, you know, who can sponsor the Academy. However, I still see many products that, as I'm walking the floor just in Philadelphia a couple of days ago, I see many products that I wouldn't necessarily recommend to my clients. So there's still an issue. And the bottom line is it's expensive to be a sponsor and to exhibit at the Academy at Fancy. So who has those dollars? And a lot of times it's food products higher up on the value chain, where they actually are, you know, making more money on their products rather than the commodities or the whole food ingredients, where they just may not have that budget. So it's kind of a sad reflection.
So if I manufactured some product and I was going to spend a lot of money on marketing dollars to try to get consumers to buy this product, and it had all kinds of ingredients in it, and not, you know, they may be fine, but still lots of things you can't pronounce that have more consonants than vowels in the words that are back on the label. I could buy a booth and pass out information and maybe give out free samples and that sort of things to the dietitians. Whereas some would like them to be able to screen me out and say that, mm-hmm. Okay, you have to apply and describe the product you're going to bring in, because we're not going to let just everybody come in and dominate the floor and have a whole bunch of this kind of product. So they would be refusing to let some food products be represented in the future. Mm-hmm. I sure worded that awkwardly, Sharon. Could you help me kind of sort that out?
Yeah, it's really a difficult situation, because how do you define, which products should be allowed to be, to be on the floor, and where do you draw the line? For example, some large food companies may have one really unhealthful product, but then they could have a healthful line. So, is it okay if they only represent their healthful product? Like they might have orange juice, but then be selling soda on the side, So, it's very, it's not really black and white in some of these areas, but a lot of dietitians really wish that that the Academy had really strict standards on, it's interesting, because even some grocery stores have standards of which food products they'll even allow to be sold at their supermarket. And they have very strict guidelines, like these are the ingredients we will not include in any product sold in our supermarket. So sometimes I look at that and I think, well, couldn't the Academy use that as a guideline? But it is frustrating. Although over the years, I have to say, the exhibition hall to me is looking better than it used to. I see healthier ingredients. And I also think that's a reflection of what consumers want. I think there are a lot of food companies that are making healthier products than there were 10 years ago. There's more of this emphasis on clean eating now. So consumers want products with fewer ingredients, clear labels, you know, less processed, highly processed ingredients and all those ingredients that you can't pronounce. Consumers want fewer of those kinds of things. So that's reflected in the exhibition hall.
You know, we know that they want fewer. They say that. And yet, on the other hand, we also hear that they want to understand how the food is being produced. And that takes space on labels. You know, I know from a dietitian standpoint, you often tell people to look at the back of the bottle, the jar, the can, the box, and read the nutrition panel. And, you know, you can explain to people what they should be looking at beyond just the calories per serving. And incredibly, those chips I like so much, it's like 7 chips or a serving or something. It's always bad. It's always bad news. I try not to read it too closely. But now we're talking about trying to have a story as to, okay, it came from here, it was grown this way, and then it describes maybe sustainability. I'm wondering whether dietitians are guiding their patients and their clients, and if they are writing blogs and podcasts and so forth, are they at all guiding people towards understanding what questions to ask about how their food is produced, or what they should understand about claims about production systems, like whether they're organic or whether they're GMO or antibiotic or hormone? Are dietitians getting into that?
Yeah, there are. A lot of dietitians are interested in that, and I'm very interested in that area as well, and I believe that dietitians should be involved with that, because who else is going to be talking to people, because we're the ones talking about food choices, so we're right there, and we can also educate people in those areas. But unfortunately, a lot of dietitians themselves are not educated in some of these areas because it wasn't part of our training. This is, you know, changing in our profession, but there is increasing information provided to dietitians on things like sustainability, how food is produced, agriculture, and those kinds of things. But people are more interested in that, and dietitians can help them.
You know, it's complicated. You said something awfully interesting right there, too, and that is the dietitians don't have enough training in that area. Maybe that's something that should be getting more attention at FEMSI, of training them about farming practices.
I think so. It's kind of hard to do that in a seminar type setting, but there is a lot more attention to agriculture and sustainability in the conference now. You're seeing it as major topics every single year. So there is a lot more attention, and you're seeing dietitians going on farm tours. I've, held a lot of farm tours myself, attended many farm tours, and these are all really important because, you know, more and more of us live in cities. We're removed from agriculture. And, you know, we just don't have that kind of knowledge to share with others. So we need more education.
You know, even when they start getting into climate change, which you mentioned earlier with Dr. Willett's panel presentation and so forth, you know, there's just so much more to get into. For example, say dairy products, that people were concerned about dairy cattle when you look at the carbon footprint. The methane, which is produced when cows belch, is a greenhouse gas, and it's a serious greenhouse gas. But the areas where they are producing so much more milk, because say here in the States, in many places in the States, compared to somewhere else, that per cow the production of milk is a fraction. So you end up having the carbon footprint per gallon of milk might be a fraction of what it is in a developing country. And it's pretty complicated. I mean,
it's very complicated.
And yet, you know, so I guess what that does lead to is there's many examples. I won't go through all of them, but there are many examples like that, that where the food is produced is important.
Yeah.
It comes from all over the world. But at some point in time, I've always keep saying that people are going to be more concerned about the water quality. When you end up having pollution is so extreme in some areas, and that's those areas may be using polluted waters to irrigate their crops, we're going to be exposed to more heavy metals.
There's so many issues. You just described some. The last romaine lettuce outbreak was related to animal agriculture being right next to a lettuce farm. So that, mm-hmm. What do you do about that? You know, how can you not have like mixed agriculture in states? So there are so many issues. And then we have the issue of, you know, it's more efficient. Efficiency is a really sustainable thing. You know, productivity efficiency is sustainable because you're using less resources to produce a higher volume. But then that also brings concerns about like too much manure from animal farms for the land, and then runoff, you know, nitrogen runoff into our waterways and dead zones. So it's so complicated. And California, you know, we both live in California. They're becoming leaders on, you know, achieving the Paris Climate Accord, and achieving some of these really lofty goals for reducing carbon footprint for many different types of food and agriculture. So that's encouraging, but it's really complicated. And, you know, we can grow things more efficiently in California in certain areas with less resources. So maybe that outweighs transportation. Sometimes we put so much attention on transportation in sustainability. People don't want their food to travel so far, which is a good thing to be concerned about. But if one place can make it so much more efficiently with less resources, it might be better for them to make that crop and then, distribute that to a larger area. So it's just very individual based on the crop and you know, the food.
Well, and then some things just don't grow. You know, I mean, we're growing almonds in California and they don't grow them in Indiana. So they're going to be getting their almonds, from California, the place that they come from. And, you know, the other issue that I'm learning more and more is that even state regulations vary a lot. You know, I've focused a lot on country of origin, which I think is important to know. But it turns out states are. I mean, if you talk to some of the California farmers, they feel like its regulations are excessive. To many times they feel they're excessive. Mm-hmm. And they can't use products in California that a competitive commodity producer in another state, and I won't even mention the state, but I get to use all those products. And, you know, you don't realize that when you're buying certain products, certain pesticides that are applied liberally in one state aren't even allowed in another state, like in the state of California.
Exactly.
I can see the dietitians and their consumers might like to know that.
Right. It takes a lot to learn those things, and they change all the time. And the average consumer has no idea about some of these issues because you can't put it on a food label, you know, that it's grown in California that has a different, you know, that doesn't have that particular pesticide used in the state. So how do you communicate all of that? It's so complicated and nuanced. So dietitians getting more educated in this area, it's really important.
And they are having their own podcast, and they're having their own blogs, and they're writing books like you.
That's right.
You're speaking. You've written two or three books now.
Two books with a third on the way.
So name the books again.
So my first book is The Plant Powered Diet, which is kind of a guide for eating a more plant-based diet, no matter what kind of diet you're on. And it provides like step-by-step tools and recipes. And then my second book is Plant Powered for Life, which is a plant-based cookbook with easy tips on how you can eat a more plant-based diet.
And what's the one you're working on?
So my third one is we don't have a title yet, but it's on the California lifestyle and plant-based eating. So it'll be a cookbook with some inspiring information about the kind of the lifestyle of plant-based eating in different parts of California and different traditions and cuisines. So it should be a fun, delicious book, and I'm excited about that one.
And you have been involved in writing articles, doing blogs. Are you doing Instagram now too?
Yes, I'm on Instagram, Sharon Palmer RD, which is also for my Twitter. And I have a Facebook page, Sharon Palmer, the Plant Power Dietitian. And you can sign up for my free newsletter on my blog, which is SharonPalmer.com, or you can also find it at ThePlantPowerDietitian.com.
And I was just fixing something to eat last night. I couldn't find much that looked like a balanced meal. So I got a paper plate out, covered it with taco chips, and piled shredded cheese on top of it with some jalapenos, and then salsa, and then microwaved it and had that with a beer. Would that pass anybody's nutritional?
Oh, where's your vegetables?
I'm hoping I can count that little diced jalapenos maybe. And and I don't know, corn chips, do they count as corn?
No,
probably not. No corn chips. And then the salsa, I know the salsa was good, right?
Yes, the salsa is good. But so I would just add some romaine lettuce on there, maybe some diced bell peppers or cucumbers, and then I would approve maybe some beans. That would be cool.
Oh, I always have beans.
Okay.
Yeah, you know what? I could.
Yeah.
Because
I
just keep some black beans, cans of black beans, because usually when I break down or take these tortillas, and you can put some black beans on and some cheese and some salsa. But it's a good idea to get some other greens. I always wondered about what you should call it, chop up. How do you get, because, you know, this isn't one of these things I advertise very often, because I have a feeling this wouldn't pass muster.
The vegetables, and Americans are always short of vegetables. So, you know, like something like 9% of Americans meet their vegetable recommendations. So that's always the thing that's the most difficult for people to fit in.
Yeah, but you give me a good idea, though. I mean, things like the peppers that you could easily keep them in the refrigerator, and some greens that you can shred, and you can, when you're having something like, I know you can never recommend people that they fill up a plate full of chips and cover it with cheese, because it's pretty bad. But if it's going to be part of what you're eating, and you can easily go to the refrigerator and pull out some green or red peppers and slice those up, or open a can of, you know, black beans or something like that, then that makes it pretty easy, even if you don't think you have anything else in the house to eat.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to go. Yeah, and a lot of these things are easy, you know, like canned beans are so easy, they're inexpensive, you know, the salsa. And then, you know, if you just keep some of the things, you know, I always like to make sure in my refrigerator I have some sort of a green leafy vegetable, like a salad green or kale or spinach or something, romaine. And then I always like to have bell peppers, because those can go into a stir fry, a salad, a casserole. You know, they're so versatile. Onions, you know, and then I supplement that with whatever seasonal vegetables. But those are always in my refrigerator, because you can turn that into a meal really quickly.
I have been hinted to me that you have canned diced tomatoes in your cupboard too.
Those are always there.
I know. I love them too. I pull them out. And I have to admit, I do green beans too. I always just have cans of green beans. They're pretty easy. Somebody told me once, though, that when you open those canned green beans, you should rinse them off, because they've got so much salt in the brine that it's just better to rinse them off before you.
Yeah, all canned vegetables, if you're trying to reduce sodium, which is a good thing, if you rinsed, whether it's canned beans, you know, canned green beans, corn, if you rinse them off, you can reduce the sodium by about 50%. Just that little thing right there. So that's a pretty healthy habit.
So if you decide to give them information on how to put taco chips all over a plate, smother them in cheese and put jalapenos on, and how they could add vegetables to that, you don't have to give me credit for that.
I'll remember that.
Yeah, but you know what? That's a good takeaway for me, though. I really do think those are some good ideas, because sometimes you just put something together like that, and you know you probably shouldn't, but you do, and you think, well, how could I possibly add vegetables to this? Mm-hmm. And you pointed out, you can.
Yeah, if you try to add vegetables to pretty much everything, you're in a winning situation.
So you were mentioning you always keep in your refrigerator some greens and some peppers, and what else? What else are vegetables?
Onions. I always have onions. I usually have potatoes because I can turn to those. And then I have fresh seasonal vegetables, whatever is in season. I go to my farmer's market, and I have my own vegetable garden. So we live in California, so we have two growing seasons, really. I have my summer season, which you can see in the farmer's market where you can get, you know, your tomatoes and your eggplant and squash, summer squash. And then the cooler weather season where you can get carrots and radishes and greens, peas, all those kinds of things. So I try to follow the seasons, and I always, you know, stock my refrigerator with produce, and then I'm just using that all week long. Like tonight, I'm going to be making a thick lentil soup because I have some lentils, of course, I keep on hand, and I have carrots, and I have some peppers, and I'm going to put some potatoes in there. So that's what's for dinner tonight.
Oh, that sounds great. How do you feel about something like broccoli wokley? I mean, we get to having broccoli and cauliflower chunks around, and then maybe to dip them in hummus or yogurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great thing. Broccoli and cauliflower, the cruciferous vegetable family, which includes broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, those are really good to have in your diet a few times a week. They're linked with cancer protection. So I do have those every week in some form there in our diet too.
What about hummus? How do you feel about hummus?
Oh, I can't live without hummus. It's always in my refrigerator.
Another one that can get you through a meal. I mean, if you're finding yourself hungry and you don't have time to go fix something, I found if you can open up, you know, pull off some broccoli or cauliflower and always have hummus on hand, you know, mm-hmm. dipping the broccoli and cauliflower in the hummus, maybe celery too, which I use almond butter on my celery though too.
That's good. Yeah. You know, one thing people don't know, if you're out of hummus, you can make homemade hummus so quickly by just taking a can of chickpeas or garbanzos, same thing, draining the liquid, but saving the liquid, tossing it in your blender with a couple garlic cloves, a big spoonful of tahini, which is sesame seed paste, a little olive oil, a little lemon juice, and then salt and pepper, and just puree it and add a little bit of that chickpea liquid from the can just to get it the consistency you like, and you're done. So you could literally make hummus in like 5 minutes. So if you're, and it makes a big batch, and it'll taste better than any hummus you get in the supermarket.
Well, that sounds great. The other easy thing I found is that I was able to give up, you know, having any jelly ever, and instead just keep fruit. So, you know, mm-hmm. get some really nice whole grain sourdough. We've got a great baker close by. I'll have a slice of that toast in the morning and put almond butter on it and then cover it with blueberries.
And, that is so good. I love it.
Yeah, it's really tasty. So I'm working at it, Sharon. And if other people are working on it too and they want to find the information you have online, tell me again where they can either find your books, where they should look at the website and give your Twitter hashtag and so forth.
Yeah, you can find all my information at my website and blog, which is SharonPalmer.com or ThePlantPoweredDietitian.com. It all goes to the same place. And so you can find, I write a daily blog. I have a lot of free resources. You can sign up for my free newsletter. I have all my recipes on there, and you can find out about my books there too. And then you can follow me on social media at SharonPalmerRD. So that's at SharonPalmerRD. And then for Facebook, it's Sharon Palmer, the plant-powered dietitian.
So, and one of the next times we have a communication to get you on the podcast, so why don't you get ready to explain how you can fix these great dinners like you were just describing, you're working on for tonight with the lentils, and still do all of this social media writing and production and so forth. I don't know how you get it done. But I'm glad
it's a labor of love.
Thanks for sharing some of that love with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's always so much fun talking with you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.